Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 66 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I spoke with Dr. Gareth Williams, a professor of classics at Columbia University. His research interests include Latin elegiac poetry, imperial Latin poetry, Senecan philosophical prose, and Renaissance humanism. He has contributed to various projects and edited volumes in the area of Roman philosophy, and his most recent research has focused on the socio-literary culture of Renaissance Venice, an interest that recently resulted in the publication of Pietro Bembo on Etna, The Ascent of a Venetian Humanist. In this episode, we discussed his fascination with poetry and the theme of social reflection in Ovid, whether the Aeneid is original or simply a copy of Homer's works, the process of writing his new book, and making ancient material understandable to modern audiences. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy! Thank you so much for joining me today. I was really looking forward to this conversation. I want to start us out with what I hope will be a relatively easy question, which is, how did you get into ancient history and classics? It's a very niche subject, so people don't tend to just stumble into it. Some might, but it's...
Well, when I was a child, I grew up in the UK, and when I was a very young child, when I began to read, they used to have history books with different print faces. Some of them were very small print, others were much larger print. And when I was about 6, 7, 8, I started reading things like The Odyssey in a child's version, of course, and it had large print. And then I discovered, to my astonishment, that as you got older, you could buy books with smaller print faces. And it was almost as if moving from grade 1, 2, 3 onwards, the better the book, the smaller the print face. And I was interested by that because it opened up to me ancient histories that were written precisely on this principle. And then I should thank the British school system, because when I was a child, you had to do an exam called the 11 plus, and I did the 11 plus, and I got into a grammar school, and I was at the end of a tradition whereby first year students going into grammar school learnt Latin. The entire class had mandatory Latin classes, and I found it fascinating. I liked the mathematical interest and the logicality of the language, and I got moving on Latin and went from there, really. And I tried to learn Greek through very kind teachers when I was about 14, 15, and I just found a certain, up to a point, a knack for doing it, and I was certainly inflamed by doing it, and I just got ignited by the fact that I was first forced to learn Latin, and then it became a great love.
I feel like that's not super uncommon these days to find someone who said, oh yes, I was forced into one of the languages, and then I decided I sort of liked it, and then decided just to continue a little bit longer, and then people end up loving it and sticking with it, which I think is kind of awesome. Were you set by the time you wanted to go to university? Did you know, like, this is absolutely, I just want to continue and keep doing this? Or did you ever encounter some doubts and say, well, maybe I should do something else. Maybe that might be a little more profitable. Or
yeah, well, I had other interests, and yes, I did certainly think that. But I went to college, and I still found great interest, because once you actually have a grasp of the language, then you can begin to think about what writers are actually saying in those languages. And I found that a whole world was opened when I meekly encountered experts who really knew what they were talking about, because they wouldn't just give background about these authors. They would dig into them. They would open eyes about what was really going on. And that was a secondary level of interest when I discovered the depths. I didn't know the depths, but I discovered that there were depths there to be explored. And that was a whole new revelation when I was a student. And that really had a further ignition effect, because I could understand that there was an awful lot more that I just had no knowledge of, and I wanted to find it out.
Nice. And how did you go about picking what you wanted to specialize in? I mean, there are so many different categories these days. So did you always have an affinity for poetry, or did you think you might want to study something else?
No straightforward affinity for poetry only. I was very interested in prose writers, but I was interested in writers who thought about their own identities, alienation, philosophical alienation, looking for relief through philosophy, reflecting on the nature of solitude, reflecting on the nature of obligation to one's fellow humans in society, reflecting carefully about social attitudes, the nature of slavery, for example, the nature of the genders in relation to each other, and social reflection. And a writer, therefore, I came to very early on, after my undergrad phase, was Ovid. And I spent a lot of time with the poetry he wrote in exile after he was exiled by the Emperor Augustus in 8 CE. There he was in Constanza, modern Constanza, which was called Tomis in his day, on the coast of the Black Sea in what is now Romania. And he reflected very ruefully and very carefully on his own isolation, far from the Roman urban centre. He seemingly died in exile in 17 CE, and his exilic writings were to me very extraordinary, especially in a late 20th century context of a century of displacement. So many people are refugees, so many people displaced in so many ways, not just physically, but psychologically as well. And the whole idea of feeling displaced in life had great appeal at a certain time. And hence, I did my doctoral work on Ovid's exile poetry.
That's wonderful. I unfortunately didn't get to do a lot of Ovid. We did, I suppose this is pretty standard for undergraduates, but we did the Metamorphosis. I remember having certain conversations with people who didn't like Roman, ancient Roman poetry at all, but they did like the Metamorphosis. So I'm wondering, as someone who's looked at Ovid's work, is there anything that's actually inherently like super different or super special that sets Metamorphosis above other works? Or is it just the subject? Like why is it, I wonder, that people who don't like poetry or don't like Ovid for the most part usually point to that specific work?
Well, I think it's got great appeal at many different levels, because many of the stories, this is a poem about the nature of change itself, and many of the stories are very charming, disturbing, difficult, arresting, exciting, repugnant. It has all sorts of difference. And in a sense, you could call the Metamorphoses a collection of days in the life, because so many different personalities come on stage, come off stage. It's very dramatically arresting and full of verve at the most superficial level of reading. And the storylines themselves are very arresting, and it just has great momentum to it in that respect. But to me, and of course it has a very large heritage where many of the stories have been taken up by other writers, and in modern artistic experience, many visual representations, of course, have been drawn from the Metamorphoses as well. So in a way, part of the modern interest in the Metamorphoses is precisely a consequence of the diaspora of the Metamorphoses culturally. It's had a vast heritage, and that heritage has itself promoted a certain interest in the original work itself. It is extraordinarily influential in many different cultures and many different art forms. But to me, one of the great interests of the Metamorphoses is the fact that it's not a static poem on a given theme. It is about the nature of change, human development, and processes that happen to every human being are encased in this poem, which really has a finger on the pulse of life. Many other poetic forms in Greece and Rome are very attractive for all sorts of reasons and extraordinarily complex in their human insight. But as a single work that has an incredible bandwidth and openness to human experience, I, for one, think that the Metamorphoses is fairly hard to match.
That makes me want to go back and read it because I only had the opportunity to read through it once, and that was quite a while ago. Yeah, I wish I had more time with it because I don't think that I was able to really get any perspective or have any... I'm not able to say much about it just because we didn't do it more than that once. So I definitely would like to go back. But something else that I think I read somewhere, I don't even remember, but I think I read somewhere that you're also interested in ancient philosophy. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. And I would actually call Ovid very much a philosopher. And I think that to see him as not a philosopher and other writers as philosophers, that in itself is rather misleading. And in recent years, I've been very interested to promote the idea that Ovid is extremely philosophically adept. I've spent a fair bit of time with other writers like Seneca, the Stoic, a writer, a prose writer for the most part, although he did write tragedies as well. But Seneca, for one, was steeped in Ovidian poetics. And even though they are very different writers in so many ways, you can also see many cross currents that flow between them in very interesting ways as well. But yes, it is true that I got lots of interest in ancient philosophy and Roman philosophy and in later ages as well.
And so I'm very curious how you were able to use this interest in Roman philosophy in the context of Renaissance Venice, because that's something I also saw somewhere. And I love talking about Renaissance Venice. I'm not super knowledgeable because that's not my time period. That's not my era. I just watch all the miniseries that shows me how cool it is. So I would love to just hear a little bit about your work in mixing the two, because I think that's not something that would stick out as something I've heard a lot of people study.
Well, I was interested in Renaissance Venice anyway, and how Latin culture and Latin writing was received. Venice is endlessly fascinating, of course, and it's particularly interesting for me at the end of the 15th century, because Greek culture after the fall of Constantinople in 1453 was flowing towards Venice, which had many interests in the Eastern Mediterranean, and Greek language and culture began to flow via Venice into other parts of the Italian peninsula as well. And I became very interested in Pietro Bembo, one of the great literary savants of the age and a wonderful Latinist. And I became involved in thinking about his early Latin writings and how he was learning Greek along the way as well, and how he thought very creatively about the nature of Latin culture in a fast-moving environment where, of course, the printing press had come to Italy and all sorts of developments were happening among the humanists in Italy in terms of promoting a widespread Latinate culture in print. And so that was of great interest to me a few years ago. And then most recently I've drifted into spending a lot of time with a person called Ermolao Barbaro, a very extraordinary young scholar in Venice, who at a very young age wrote an incredibly learned work on celibacy, in contradistinction to a work written by his grandfather on marriage.
Oh my goodness. I think that's super fascinating, because the only thing previously that I really paid attention to that carried over from the ancient Romans to Venice was probably, just because it's the most obvious, was the architectural influences. But, I mean, it it totally makes sense. But also, I've only really looked at the ancient Romans in conjunction with Florence. I don't know why, but it's probably just because they're the more well-known ones because of the de' Medicis or something. But yeah, there's something so fascinating about Venice at that time. I was just in Italy not too long ago, and so it was kind of my time to walk around and say, oh, look at the Roman influence here, and look how it affected this. And yeah, it would be so fascinating to be able to look more into what else is there.
Yeah, it's very hard, actually, to talk about Venice without talking about other places like Milan and Florence and Rome, and the politics are very important and significant. But the wider interest here is that I think one becomes a better classicist looking at ancient texts by seeing how those texts were used, received, thought about, processed by later generations. And you know, I do find it very stimulating in that way to look at reception, because it does have great insight or added value when you then go back to things like Ovid's Metamorphoses. And the Bembos of the world, the Barbaros of the world, knew Ovid and many other writers absolutely intimately.
So interesting. And I mean, I'm just curious now that we've been talking about sort of the different poetries and the influences. And I mean, Ovid is fantastic to study as well. But in terms of just personal preference now, I'm curious to know, are you particularly a fan of Virgil's work? Because I have I had a former professor who loved everything Virgil wrote, but as someone who has studied more Ovid, you know, is there like a huge significant difference? Is it just different and it's like comparing apples to oranges? Because when we talk about these ancient works, I know more people know Virgil by name than do Ovid.
Very fair point. And of course, you know, I'm a humble reader, and Virgil is of just such specialness as to be very extraordinary. And I have spent a lot of time just learning from Virgil and spending time trying to process thoughts about Virgil. But in many ways, Ovid's Metamorphoses engages so carefully with the Aeneid in particular. And one of the best books ever written about Virgil's corpus generally is Ovid's Metamorphoses, because even though he very cheekily pushes back against the Virgilian heritage, there was no reader historically who was more insightfully engaged with Virgil's Aeneid than Ovid. And even though he very sharply comments on the Aeneid, and perhaps snidely in certain respects, there's no question about the respect in which Ovid obviously held things like the Aeneid. The Aeneid was published, or not published, was left incomplete at Virgil's death in 19 BCE. Ovid began work on the Metamorphoses about two decades later. It was impossible to write an epic poem at Rome, or an epic length poem at Rome after the Aeneid, without absolutely operating 100% in Virgil's shadow. Absolutely impossible to escape Virgil's umbra, his influence, his name. And a measure of Ovid's sheer pluck and sense of adventure and sense of self-confidence is the very fact that he was prepared to take on as challenging a cultural heavyweight as the Aeneid. The Aeneid takes its course from the fall of Troy down to the projected rise of the Emperor Augustus. And so it moves, say, over 1,000 years, 1,200 years. Ovid's Metamorphoses moves from the very beginning of the world all the way down to the projected future of Augustus's apotheosis. Virgil's Aeneid is an epic in 12 books. Ovid's Metamorphoses is written in 15 books. Already, just by looking at the dimensions, both the span of time within the poem and the number of books within Ovid's poem, he's already stretching the tectonics of Virgil's Aeneid. Virgil's Aeneid is in a very certain sense cut down to size by the supersizing that Ovid offers in writing a poem in 15 books that goes from the origin of the world, Ab origine mundi, all the way down to the projected apotheosis of Augustus.
Well, it's interesting because obviously Virgil being sort of one of the first ones and has this huge legacy now that other poets will follow. But Virgil himself follows great Greek poets and everything. So one question I love asking people who study Roman poets or poetry is, where do you stand on, was Virgil's Aeneid, like, do you see it as like super original, or is it really just Homer in reverse order, same thing, copy paste?
Oh, no, I see the Aeneid as absolutely original and fundamental, and for all sorts of reasons that are deeply artistic in very technical terms and matters. The Aeneid is extraordinarily learned, of course, and is an encyclopedia of ancient literary history, both Greek and Latin, before Virgil's day. But I also think a fundamental dimension is that it's a world apart from Homer, and it is a writing that does coincide with the rise after the first century civil wars of a new pacification under the Emperor Augustus. It's not propaganda, but it is a charter for a new vision of Rome. And in a sense, the Aeneid inevitably puts Augustus himself into perspective, because what the Aeneid offers is a vision of Roman heritage in which Augustus is a component, but only a component, because the Roman historical process is always going to be bigger than any individual within that process. In that respect, Aeneas is obviously a pioneering founder of Rome in the Aeneid, but Aeneas, in a way, is again a component and is not just straightforwardly the progenitor of Rome in an ongoing sense, that his importance remains. Aeneas, to me, is a relatively less than interesting person, and what matters is Rome itself more than any individual within the Roman everlasting structure.
I kind of like that take, to not make it so much about the man, the hero himself, because I do remember my professor saying that this was Virgil's attempt to create the template for what will become the ideal Roman hero, but he's still Trojan. He's still not quite that idealized figure, so you have to give him some attributes for future Roman heroes to model, but at the same time, he's imperfect. So it's more of like, yeah, you have to see the whole instead of the piece. He just happens to be the person that we follow. I remember her saying, basically, we should pay attention to after he lands in Italy. All the before stuff makes for a good story, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, and I think there are many good points there. But one point that you have just stated is the idea that there is a formation of what might be called a good Roman. Because if there is that, let's call it narrowing effect in the Aeneid towards shaping an ideology of what it is to be Roman, I think one of the starting points for what Ovid does in the Metamorphoses is push back against that focalization in Virgil towards a definition of what Romanness might be, because Ovid has a much more flexible view of human process and behavior. Let's consider the way in which perhaps Virgil narrows us towards a definition of what might be called Roman. I would suggest that Ovid broadens us to see a spectrum of human behavior and conduct that is much wider in certain respects. And if in that respect Virgil offers a manifesto for definition of Romanness, Ovid, it seems to me, opens a manifesto for a much wider range of human thought and expression. In that respect, it's interesting that so many characters in the Metamorphoses are odd, different, quirky, mismatches, temperamental, violent, unpleasant, pleasant, circuitous, all over the place, unsure of themselves, erratic, erotic. They just go in all sorts of different directions, as opposed to following any given template. In that respect, I might suggest that the Metamorphoses, the changefulness of the Metamorphoses, is a very deliberate pushback against the monumentalization, let's call it, of what Virgil might be engaging in.
So one's basically sort of the still propaganda and the other one is a more humanistic look, basically.
Well, I wouldn't want to call the Aeneid propaganda because it seems to me that Virgil is far too sensitive a writer to write a one-dimensional take on Augustan Rome in any way that would be seen to be straightforwardly propagandistic. Of course, there are many praises of the Emperor Augustus, but it seems to me that Augustus himself would not have necessarily wanted to greet a straightforwardly propagandistic work. Cynical intellectuals at Rome would see through such propaganda immediately.
It must have been so fascinating to be an ancient poet at the time, because I wonder sometimes, I don't think that, I mean, now as contemporary readers, we sort of read and then we always try to look in to the decisions that were being made or how things were crafted. But I sometimes sit here and think, man, it would be so interesting, because if you were an ancient writer, how much do you have to think about politics and who's emperor and what is the situation in which you're going to be writing and how will that be perceived for the contemporary audience back then versus for those in the future. So it's always really interesting to think and compare these poets, because obviously they were writing at such different times. So to see these stark differences, but and it's fun to see sort of the dialogue between one responding to a different work and the back and forth, but these are centuries between them. So it's.
But both writers are writing under the same emperor. And that is of great interest because Augustus ruled for many, many years. And both the Aeneid and the Metamorphoses are crucially conditioned by the Augustan circumstances in which they were composed. And that is a very vital thing because both poems are fundamentally political. Because to be a writer at Rome under Augustus was inevitably to be drawn into dialogue, interview, correlation with the imperial center. You could not write apolitically at Rome under Augustus, because whatever one would write would have to be seen in a cultural context, in a political context that was overwhelming and ubiquitous.
Okay, I do want to bring in another famous Roman writer, Cicero. Obviously, my timelines are a little everywhere, but just because I'm now thinking back to a conversation I had with a professor who talked a lot about using humor to get political messages across, and this was perfected in Rome. This wasn't really seen anywhere else at the time, and so I'm wondering even when Ovid and Virgil were writing and you're trying to consider, you know, what does the political situation look like? You know, we've got Augustus here. He's the emperor. He's doing this, that, and the other thing. But at that time, was humor already baked into kind of the Roman political scene where you could basically get things through regularly using humor? Or was this like still very early and we still had to see a greater movement of using humor sort of make its way into Roman political society?
Humor is absolutely fundamentally embedded in so much Roman cultural engagement. And there was a thriving comedic form at Rome under writers like Plautus and Terence. And you're quite right, Cicero's court cases, he is partly attending to a case, but he's partly attending to an audience, of course, and trying to win over an audience. And we all like humor. There are humorous touches in the Aeneid, certainly. And as we go forward into the first century CE, there are many writers who use all veins of humor, some of it off color, some of it appropriate, some of it light, some of it heavy, some of it very dark. And Ovid is masterful in using very many shades and typologies of humor. It's not to deny that there are many very grotesque aspects to the Metamorphoses, and there are many social concerns on which he touches that are disturbing and are widely perceived to be disturbing in a modern context, of course. But at the same time, many aspects of the Metamorphoses are written with a smile, and there is a great warmth and generosity to certain aspects of human conduct. And there is great kindness in many episodes in the Metamorphoses. Even though, as I hasten to add once again, there are many much more disturbing aspects of the poetry. And this is the point, in a way. The Metamorphoses offers such a bandwidth, an extent of bandwidth of human behavioral typologies. There are so many different changeful properties of humankind encased in this poem.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know why that just popped into my head suddenly about humor, but I suppose it's inherently connected to Roman culture. I mean, it was something that happened. So, So I suppose on that level, it does make sense why it popped into my head all of a sudden. But okay, so we have been discussing these great poets and their two famous works, but I am a little curious to see, why do you think that in all the pantheon of great ancient works that we've done, plays and films and TV and all these cool entertainment things, why do people not choose to do the Roman writers? They're clearly very interesting. They're not boring compared to the Greek stuff. Why do we think there's like a hesitation to do it? Is it just because people don't want to tackle that, or it's just not widely as studied? Like, I can't imagine that for cultures and people who like to study ancient Rome just as much as ancient Greece, it's just so weird how we just have such an imbalance of, I could probably go on the internet and find 50,000 different adaptations of Homer's works, but there's like two of the Aeneid.
I think it's a question of accessibility, and of course, many people have had perhaps some experience of Latin, both for good and for less than good. I think there is an expansiveness. We think of the Blue Mediterranean when we think of Homer, and we think of expansive journeying in the Odyssey. We think of great trauma. We think inevitably of, the Great Wars when we think of the Iliad. There is a point of contact with modern human life that Homer in particular does buy into. And then the Greek tragedians tap into so many aspects of modern ethical problematization of life. Perhaps in some ways the Roman writers don't have those opportunities for modern contact that Homer, the Greek tragedies, Plato have. Though I would suggest also that an important thing is communicability, and we have to present the writers to as large a modern audience as possible, as accessibly as possible. And there are many well-written books that do that wonderfully in the modern era of trying to open up Ovid and Virgil and many other writers to a modern audience. And my little book is very much intended to open Ovid as best it can in its own humble way to a modern readership by trying to see modern concerns in relation to themes that Ovid touches upon in the Metamorphoses.
Mm. And actually with that, would you tell us about your new book that just is about to come out? Because it looks fantastic, and I would hope that other people would give it a read.
Well, thanks. The book arose because at Columbia there was a core curriculum. Every incoming student at Columbia does a course in the first year called Literature Humanities, which is a week-by-week study of certain texts that have been very influential across time, from Greco-Roman antiquity all the way down to the 21st century, Toni Morrison. And the texts that are chosen are texts of great cultural importance. And 3-4 years ago, a friend of mine asked if I'd want to get involved in thinking about some kind of project of writing about authors on the core curriculum. And so we brainstormed and we came up with a proposal to think about shortish books on topics related to authors in the core curriculum generally, and not just, in fact, literature humanities. And so we established a series with the generous help of Columbia College and Columbia University Press as well. And as time gone on, we commissioned a number of volumes, and the first volumes are now beginning to appear. And one of those volumes was a book on Ovid's Metamorphoses. And in a certain sense, this was a guinea pig experiment to see what the books would look like, what the processes would be in terms of editorial practice. And we thought it appropriate that a person on the editorial board should have a go at a book, so that we could actually have a dry run at practices as we tried to grow the series. The series was inspired by a wonderful managing editor called Deborah Martinson. I make a point of thanking Deborah for so much inspiration in the preface to my book, because Deborah unfortunately passed away before the first books in the series were able to become visible. And so the series generally owes an enormous amount to Deborah Martinson. And I really want to express that acknowledgement very clearly.
I mean, it sounds wonderful. And I think for the many people who have heard of and have a passing interest in Ovid, because they first encountered him through Metamorphosis and everything, it sounds like they'll be very pleased. And I will make sure to recommend this to them, because it looks absolutely incredible. So as soon as I can find the free time, once I'm done with all my grad school adventures and paperworks here, I will be sure to pick that up and read it for sure. Is this the type of book that you would recommend to, like, people who have no background at all? Is this something you would like for, like, experts to also pick up? Who's the, like, ideal audience for your book?
This was a very interesting point. In writing one of these books, for whom were they meant? Are they meant for Columbia alumni? Are they meant for a wider audience? And this was one of the very interesting challenges in setting pen to paper. And the idea really was to have no fixed view of what reader would ideally pick up my little book. The idea, as I developed it, was to try to write in a way that would be engaging for any reader. And it does not presuppose prior knowledge of Ovid. It has no footnotes. It was very liberating to write in a spirit that was obviously in no way capable of going anywhere near the wit level and the smartness of Ovid, but trying to write in a slightly freer way than is more typical of most academic books. And no one can compete with Ovid's humour, but to write with a certain liveliness of tone that will try to express the excitement of teaching in the Columbia core curriculum and the friction that's engaged or is generated by reading through these texts with bright Columbia undergraduates who come up with ideas in all sorts of very sparky ways. And I think all of us like to read things in newspapers, in books, that are arresting and enjoyable and do have a point of contact with modern experience. And so, however successful or unsuccessful I have been, it has been a very interesting experience, at least to make the attempt at writing in a way that does try to suggest ways in which a text written 2,000 years ago can really inform daily life tomorrow.
That's wonderful. I think that's great, because it's wonderful as someone with a background in classics to be able to feel like, yes, I would feel confident enough to pick the book up and dig into it. But it sounds like, you know, I would also feel comfortable handing it to my mother, who knows nothing at all about classics or any of the ancient writers besides Homer. But even then, she only sort of heard of it long ago. So, yeah, no, this is something I definitely would feel comfortable sharing with her. And in terms of, because this is on someone and about a topic that also just isn't super known to the wider public, I know classics as a field is dealing with a lot of issues of, well, how do we become more palatable to people outside, and how do we communicate so we're not losing funding and this, that, and the other thing. Like, eventually, I'm not sure if it's possible with this book, and it may not be, which is totally fine because we understand the struggles, but eventually, is this the type of thing that you would like to be open access so more people can have access to it and interact with it, and not only with what you've written, but then hopefully with people within the field, people studying it?
I want literature generally to be as widely available to as many readers as possible, because it seems to me that, of course, there are commercial practices tied up with literature, but literature is a means of conveying human experience to fellow humans. And the more people who can have contact with great literature will be able to widen their experience. And as a classicist, I don't want to be a classicist in the very narrowly defined sense that I write only for a very small group of scholars. I would hope to convey an excitement about the ancient world and ancient literature that will hopefully encourage others to engage with these cultural practices, which strike me as extraordinary. I want to do something, however little and however impoverished it might be, to encourage others to engage with writers I believe to be extremely rich, provocative, and useful. Because above all, I think the idea that classicists just spend their time looking at a remote past that is now detached from realities is not correct, in the sense that so much of what we live through in daily experience now, we find such careful thought, rumination upon, consideration about in the ancient texts. And in many ways, I regard Ovid's Metamorphoses as an extremely modern work that was in fact written only yesterday.
Now, I'm a bit curious, because I don't really talk to people who study ancient poetry all that often, just because that wasn't my thing when I was a student, so I kind of hung out with those who studied material culture and some of the other stuff. So I'm curious. We have a long, wonderful tradition of poetry, obviously stemming from the ancient world, and we still have a lot of great poets through the years leading up to today. So I'm kind of curious, is there a more contemporary, it doesn't have to be like right now, it can still be a bit back in time, but a more contemporary poet that you think really does justice to, or sort of has similar types of works to some of these ancient poets? Because sometimes I like to sit and think about, oh, well, I wonder who really is kind of carrying on the flame, the legacy, because we have access to a lot of these ancient works, and throughout the years, we're always influenced by the past, so I always get a little curious, and yeah, like, did someone really study their ancient poetry? Does anyone sort of emulate this or bring out the spirit of it really well?
Yes, I think there are many cases, and an immediate case would be Shakespeare, who uses so many models, and not just Ovidian models, of course, but thinks so carefully about, you know, the literary production of the ancient past and how it can be reused and recycled in all sorts of inventive ways and extremely novel ways. And then, you know, modern writers, you know, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, are so thoughtful in how they do engage with the past, and Walt Whitman as well, and many other writers, both male and female. And I think what's so stirring about that is how they take from Ovid not just points or storylines that they adapt, but they take essences, they take the spark of creativity, and they see in what Ovid is doing the challenge of taking a received tradition and subverting it, turning it around, adding to it, innovating. And I think it's the intellectual restlessness of a writer like Ovid that becomes so powerful in terms of the later tradition, so that writers like Dante are so restless in response to that kind of stimulation. And that is why Ovid is endlessly fascinating. I don't think it's possible to write a definitive book on the Metamorphoses, because the Metamorphoses always slides off into another indistinct area. It's a bit like trying to nail down a jelly.
Wow. Yeah. That would be pretty difficult. So, you know, there are so many great poets I can think of in great works. And it's, yeah, you know, it's quite interesting, because there are so many events and interesting historical people that, I mean, we study when we study the classics. And sometimes I sit here and think, oh man, wouldn't it be fun if there was, if there could have been an ancient work written about this specific instance or this specific person. So just to sort of have a little fun with it as we're sort of getting toward the end. I'm curious, you know, is there any historical figure in ancient Rome or incident that you wish these writers could have tackled? I mean, that clearly happened after their time, but there's so many fun things that happen in history that sometimes I'm like, oh, if only Homer could have written about the Peloponnesian War, if only Homer could have written about something else. So is there anything in Roman history that you wish they could have gotten to?
Oh, many points, and that's a great observation. But one of the interesting points to me, when I think about Ovid, is it's remarkable that so few writers say anything about Ovid's exile as a historical fact. And there are those modern scholars who believe that Ovid, in fact, was never exiled, and that the whole thing is a fiction, and that what he was portraying was the idea of being an outsider at Rome itself. It's a very interesting idea to play with, not one I actually subscribe to myself, for very particular reasons, but the very proposal that he never went into exile but writes exilic poetry while remaining at Rome is enticing, because one of the interesting commonalities between Ovid's own life experience and what goes on in the Metamorphoses is that the Metamorphoses is chock full of people who are outsiders in life, who are exiles, misfits, not quite fitting into a given social context. And in that respect, I would be very interested to reflect upon, think about why there is so little in the historical record about Ovid's exile, if it did indeed actually happen. And I should also say that I don't for a moment overlook the fact that there are many aspects of the Metamorphoses that are discomforting from a modern viewpoint. The Metamorphoses was written in a slave society. There is a lot of sexual violence, of course, and that is a feature of the poem that continues to cause great upset and concern. I don't disguise that for a moment. And in that respect, I do think that Ovid's Metamorphoses does project a vision of a culture without varnishing that culture. Roman culture was in many ways a very harsh, brutal culture, of course. And that does come through in this poem, even though there are aspects that do show that Ovid himself really has it in for bullies in the world and for those who are violent in a very premeditated and sadistic way.
It would be very interesting, and I'm surprised that more authors haven't tackled Ovid's exile than, it's interesting just because I feel like so many things back then, they're remarked upon, people spread rumors, especially like in ancient Athens, people were ostracized all the time and people would talk about it. So it is quite strange to learn that people just don't really talk about it or believe that it happened. So I would like to see or hear more about that done. Great mystery.
No, it is an extraordinary historical vacuum, you know, that there's very little mention of something so momentous. And he was, of course, you know, an Oscar Wilde figure, very famous in his own time.
Wonderful. I have three questions I generally like to ask at the end of the interview portion of the podcast, which is the first was, and I know in the UK it was different. So, like, was there a type of office hours in the UK when you were going to school that was either, like, not maybe a formal, like, here you can come to my office at this time, and I know the UK system has lecturers and who don't really do that, but you have the tutorials which do, but was there any sort of formal or informal time that resembled an office hour that you were able to attend when you were in school?
Oh yes, and you had easy access to tutors, teachers, lecturers, and they were extraordinarily generous, and so there was something akin to an office hour process, but a great camaraderie. And I'm very grateful to teachers across the decades who've shown great generosity of time, and access in that way was wonderful. So warm and generous.
And out of all these experiences and the time you did have, is there like a particular memory or something fun that happened that sticks out to you from one of these conversations, meetings?
Well, I think, when I do look back, student days were great fun and they went very quickly, of course. Just the camaraderie, especially among graduate students in those days, and many of my friends have gone on to very distinguished careers. pulling together, you know, an understanding that we're all trying to serve the same general cause. And, you know, I think that's a very important thing. It's not about us. It's about the writers and the texts, and what can be done to serve these texts. When I'm gone, I would hope that at least I've tried to make a little ripple effect, you know, in my little writing on Ovid's Metamorphoses, and try to inject something. But I do want to show that, in fact, I read a poem very carefully and it has an effect on me. Whether what I write has an effect on anyone else is not up to me. But in that sense, I think that writing on a poem such as the Metamorphoses, it is inevitably a very personal experience.
And in your capacity now as a professor who has office hours, if you had to give a little elevator pitch to students for why they should attend office hours, what would you tell them?
One point I would make is whether you're a physics student, whether you're a mathematics student, whether you study chemistry or whether you study French literature or classics, professors, in my experience, tend to be really interested in undergraduates. Just say hello, have a chat. It seems to me that you will get very good formal instruction in college, but why not just try to spend 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes talking to somebody who's interested in you, and you'll just get to see the broader picture behind the fewer knowledge in that person. Just as, you know, in most interactions on a daily basis, it's nice to get a more rounded view of a person. And I find that if I have a chance to discuss with a graduate student or an undergraduate a piece of work, you begin to see how the piece of work relates to the wider life of the person. And surely, the more we know about a person, the better informed we are about the work they do, the attitudes they have. And isn't college really fundamentally a process of understanding through dialogue? And office hours, it seems to me, give a chance for that dialogue.
Couldn't have put it better myself. And some professors just have nice incentivizing treats. My favorite professor had a chocolate drawer, so I would go just for the chocolate. No, I'm kidding. I would go to see her. But the chocolate was a perk.
Very good.
And so at the end of each podcast, I ask every guest if they would read Percy Shelley's beautiful Ozymandias poem. And so if you could read the poem and then just give us your opinion, your thoughts on what is this poem, what do you think it means? And it's routinely been cited as a poem of significance, and a lot of people say that they find great meaning in it. And so I'm curious to know if you agree and whatever else.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yeah.
Well, here goes. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. It is a great poem, and I'm obviously no expert, and I wouldn't claim to have any real insight, but it's, to me, very Herodotean, the humbling of a king, king of kings, and then we become sand of sands as the tide of time just moves us on. And perhaps what we should think about is that when we see the Great Pyramids, for example, we don't just see a monument to a wonderful cultural age and sophistication. We also see a wonderful memento mori, reminder that even the greatest cultures will evolve and develop in ways that might humble us a little bit. And in that respect, is Shelley not on the same page as Ovid in understanding that change is fundamental to human experience, whether we like it or not? Should we not therefore embrace change rather than try to push it to one side? If we embrace change, it seems to me that we will quickly reach for a copy of Ovid's Metamorphoses.
Well, that's very astute. As someone who looks at ancient Roman poetry, I think that really helps. And it really does still influence how we look at modern poetry, because I couldn't have said it better myself. Because I always say, yes, it speaks clearly as being a memento mori. I mean, this is a 14-line sonnet. You know, it's not long, but it's succinct, and Shelley knew what he was writing, and this idea of monumentality and legacy. And so, yes, I'm not afraid to say it. It is my favorite poem of all time. I know it's very bold to say that because there are a lot of great poems floating around from history, but yeah, there's something super powerful about this one. And so since we have established that it really is a memento mori, I want you to think for a minute, and if you consider our contemporary culture right now, do we have a sort of modern Ozymandias something that we think is awesome and amazing and like the best thing since sliced bread, but realistically, will future humans, a couple hundred years from now, will they still see it as such, or will something have crumbled and just been like, wow, that was a terrible idea. What were we thinking? What were humans doing at that time? Because this is horrible.
Well, it's not for me to say, of course, but I wonder, the internet is a marvel of modern experience, but how will it be perceived in, say, 50 years' time? As this remarkable connector that's a force only for good, or might it be seen over time as a force for intermingling between cultures, nations, peoples, etc., that has mixed effects, perhaps? And do we yet know, or is the internet yet old enough for us to fully understand the social implications of a phenomenon that has changed all our lives in the last 25, 30 years? And do we yet understand the full implications of that remarkable human development?
That's a great point, because I don't think so. I mean, I was in conversation with someone the other day, and at the tender age of 27 years, I still told someone, well, I kind of remember before Google was Google, and 27 isn't that much time spent on Earth. I mean, I think because I maybe it was over New Year's, but I brought it up, but I just said, oh, I remember what Ask Jeeves was, unsurprisingly, because we were talking about Jeeves here in the TV show with the Jeeves character.
Witch hats.
Yes, Peachy exactly. Witch hats. So we were talking about that at New Year's, and I just said, well, wasn't there an Ask Jeeves? And an older friend of mine piped up and said, yes, in fact, that was before Google was Google. We had Ask Jeeves. And I said, wait, if I'm old enough to remember that, oh my gosh, the internet's like super young then. And so that realization dawned on me, and then I got all freaked out, and then I said, well, the first iPhone came out in like 2007 when I was already in eighth grade or something. So I was like, oh my goodness, I feel so old. Or it just shows how young technology truly is. And I think you're onto something. I think you're right. How could we possibly understand the implications of this thing that we now rely on and that some people feel like addicted to? I don't think it's uncommon to hear people say, like, oh, without my iPhone, I feel naked. Like, I don't feel like I have anything. My world is not at my fingertips. I can't just Google something whenever I want to. My life is on that phone. So yeah, I couldn't have said it better. So I kind of lied, and I will actually ask you one more thing. The last question I will actually ask you is, where can people find you if they're interested in sending you an email, hoping to study with you, ask you about your book or your research?
They can just email me, gdw5@columbia.edu.
Wonderful. And do you happen to have an academia page?
I do. I think I do.
Well, I will double check, and if you do have an academia page, I will link it in our show notes, so people, if you have an account, people can hopefully find your work on there.
Well, it's very kind. The trouble is, I was so busy writing the book, I didn't really have such a sharp eye on all the peripherals.
No, that's fine. Well, I was going to say, do you have any planned events or openings or anything for the book launch?
Columbia is thinking of a book launch, and I'll go along to that. But, you know, I just will go with the flow. That's what Ovid teaches us.
I think that's a brilliant strategy. So what I will do then is, since this episode won't be out for the next several months, if there is a book launch, then I will come back and I will add the info into the show notes so people can find any press or book launch, if there is any, and they can find it from there. And then I will also, as soon as it becomes available to purchase from anywhere, I will put in a link to your book so people can go find it. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure, and I hope to have you back on at some point. I don't know in what capacity yet, but I'd love to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you for having me this morning, and it's a great pleasure, of course, and great to have the conversation.
Definitely.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.